we turn to Case 5, Hampton versus Ford Motor Company.
Good morning. Ernest Rossiello for the appellant. As your honors know, this case arises the efficacy of a waiver and release signed by the plaintiff, who was an employee of Ford Motor Company. Form, pre-printed release offered to approximately 75,000 or more employees at about the same time, which was intended to be a buyout to procure the voluntary resignation of over 75,000 Ford employees for the stated purpose in the literature to allow Ford to improve its cost structure and competitive position in the marketplace. The document was not intended to be a specific release of this case. After the plaintiff filed a charge of discrimination for sexual harassment against Ford approximately a year before she signed this waiver. And during the pendency of the charge, Ford Motor Company knew that this employee was represented by counsel. They had written notice of it. They had letters from my office. Employees were told that they could come to the factory on South Torrance Avenue and sign the agreement. If they didn't sign it, that was their option. It was totally voluntary. The employees were not permitted to take the form off the premises. They had to sign it right then and there. The plaintiff, as a result of the sexual harassment and of a previous medical condition, was bipolar. It's in the record that she was treated for as an inpatient psychiatric patient during the pendency of her charge of discrimination. And after the lawsuit was filed, approximately a month and a half after she signed this agreement, I'm on borrowed time here. Somebody else was done. Thank you. I always live dangerously. to make your job easier, you don't need to reach three of the four issues in the defendant's brief. The district court never got to the merits of the sexual harassment issue. The district court, without citing a single case, said that the release was a complete bar and a waiver of the suit and dismissed the Title VII case on the summary judgment. Now, we believe that the district court mistakenly did so because he decided what the intention of the parties was as a matter of law, when we believe it is a question of fact. Judge Rovner when she was on the district court, decided a case, the Smith versus Orrington Hotel, which is analogous, saying that when someone signs a release, they have to know what they sign, and also it's important that the parties intend for the document to be a release. This was not intended to be a release. If you look in the appendix that we've attached, we have a copy of that waiver agreement, and the waiver agreement makes no mention to this lawsuit. It also says that it doesn't waive any future rights. She hadn't gotten her right to sue letter at the time she signed it. She got it a month and a half later. But I think the critical reason why this is not effective is are manyfold. I came up with about 15 or 16 different reasons why this release should not be enforced. First, it's vague. The law is clear, and I think the Supreme Court in Alexander versus Denver Carton said that that a Title VII case clearly can be released. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But it has to be clearly explained to the plaintiff. There has to be a clear explanation, and it must be the intention of the parties to release the claim.
Well, if it was Ford's intention to get rid of all claims against it by giving this release form to people like your client.
That's,
did your client have to pay back the $100,000, tender back the $100,000?
Well, the defendant says they do, that she does.
Well, what, why doesn't that make sense?
Well, it does make sense if you have a good relationship. I mean, if, well,
if Ford thinks it's buying, it's paying off employees, so all disputes you have with the company or any other rights you have, except I think age discrimination here, is being waived by the board, why shouldn't a tender of the return of the $100,000 be a precondition to going forward here with a...
with her Title VII case?
Yeah.
Well, the consideration for the document was not the Title VII case. The consideration was the same consideration offered to 75,000 other employees to resign. And that's what the whole purpose of it was. If you look at the materials that I attach in my appendix, it says the purpose of the buyout was to assist Ford in to allow Ford to improve its cost structure and competitive position in the marketplace. My office did not participate in this. She was not allowed to take that contract, that waiver, off the premises. She had to sign it right then and there. And I didn't find out about it. I didn't see it until January, after it effectively had, become effective. I didn't see it. And I looked at it, and it doesn't say anything about a Title VII case. The money didn't come through my office. I got no fee out of it. Maybe that's why I'm mad. But it was not clearly explained to her that she was waiving her Title VII case. She already had the case. She had the charge pending. There's nothing in there saying that it released that charge. I mean, had it done so, Ford would be 100% correct. Then she gets her right to sue letter a month and a half. She got the right to sue letter about a month after she signed it, I think November 17th, 06. She signed it October 16th, 06, November 1706, she gets a right to sue letter. The release and waiver also says right there that it does not waive any rights or claims that may arise after this waiver is signed or if it is not permitted by law. Well, we don't think it's permitted by law, under contract law. There was no consideration for the release or dismissal of the Title VII charge. The woman is bipolar. She's got a mental issue. Nobody explained to her before she signed it the effect of the signature on it. It was the same form pattern agreement given to over 75,000 other employees, which, I mean, of course, they certainly have a right to do. They knew she had a lawyer. They circumvented my office. She had to sign it right there in front of the union rep on the premises. I didn't get to see it until January, until after it took effect. I didn't even know she got paid the money until after she told me she got the money and she spent it. So, there was no intention to release that claim. The same deal was given to everybody else. Her attorney was never consulted. She didn't have the benefit of counsel before she signed it. The payment was sent directly to her and not through my office. I mean, if I had gotten some correspondence from them, and they certainly knew that I represented her because I had an appearance on file at the EEOC, and also they had gotten correspondence from my office, I probably would have modified it and said, okay, this is a good deal, but let's put the Title VII case in there and wipe that out as well. But she was just swept in what's a reduction in workforce, a buyout of some 75,000 people. And we believe there was no specific consideration for the release of that claim. Under the Supreme Court decision, there has to be a clear explanation of the waiver of the right of a Title VII claim. And there also has to be what the cases say are real negotiations. If you look at Judge Lefkoe's case, Milam versus Dominix, it's very much on point. Milam versus Dominix, Judge Rovner's case when she was on the district court, Smith versus Orrington, it's the same thing. Thank you. I'd like to save my time.
Ms. Nemchek?
May it please the Court. Good morning. I'm Kathy Nemechek on behalf of the respondent, Ford Motor Company. The district court got it right here when, on a fully developed summary judgment record, they decided that there was no genuine issue of material fact as to the scope or enforceability of the waiver agreement that plaintiff executed on October 16, 2006. The analysis that the district court went through and that this court should look at is that set forth in this court's opinions in the Pierce versus Atchison Topeka cases, Pierce 1 and Pierce 2, both cited in our brief. In those cases, the court came up with a test for determining whether an individual had knowingly and voluntarily given up their rights under a federal anti-discrimination claim such as Title VII. The Pierce kind of set forth a three-prong analysis, first looking at whether the language of the release is clear and unambiguous and governs the claims at issue. Second, whether the release was supported by consideration. And then third, whether or not in multi-factor test the release was knowing and voluntary. And we provided evidence to the court, we believe, below that supports all three of those in favor of Ford. With respect to the language at issue, it's in the appendix to both of the parties' briefs. The language is very simple. The language is very clear. It says, I waive and release any and all rights or claims I may have against Ford Motor Company, its agents or employees, and agree not to institute any proceedings of any kind against Ford, its agents or employees relating to my employment or my termination therefrom. Just such language has been found sufficient to release Title VII claims by this court in Pierce 1, this court in the NutraSuite, Wagner versus NutraSuite case, and other cases cited in our brief. In fact, the Pierce 1 case, the plaintiff had a pending charge of discrimination and entered into an agreement which had almost identical language, and the court found that that language was sufficient to get rid of a pending EEOC charge, a pending claim, despite the fact that the claim was not actually listed out by line item in the case. With respect to ambiguity, I think that's an issue that was raised for the first time really in the reply brief on appeal. If the court looks at what was submitted to the district court, I don't think plaintiff ever cited any case law nor really argued that there was an ambiguity in the contract, but I think the contract, as the court can look at itself, is very clear, and if there was a mistake as to intent, it was certainly a unilateral mistake on behalf of the plaintiff and not a mutual mistake on behalf of the parties. And the intention of the parties is first determined by looking at the contract, which, again, is very clear. With respect to consideration, plaintiff doesn't contest. She got $100,000 minus withholdings and that she would not have gotten that money had she not signed the waiver agreement. Plaintiff seems to suggest that 75,000 people got this money. That's not correct. That's only supported in the record by something that the plaintiff's counsel printed off the Internet and that was unauthenticated. The agreement was offered to a class of employees, but each employee who received the money had to sign a waiver agreement. With respect to the knowing and voluntary piece of the Pierce analysis, Pierce 2 said that the plaintiff has the initial burden of production in showing that this waiver was not knowing or voluntary. And I think it's very significant that nowhere in the record, not in her deposition, not in the affidavit she submitted in response to our summary judgment brief, did she ever say that she did not understand what she was doing. She pointed to, or her counsel has made a number of arguments here, but she's never said, I was confused, I felt pressured, I didn't understand any of this. All the arguments, I think, are made by counsel, and she's never suggested that she didn't have adequate time or didn't understand what she was doing. If we look at the factors that the Pierce Court directs the court to look at, the language, again, is clear and unambiguous here. With respect to plaintiff's education and ability to understand, she had a high school degree, she had some college, she'd worked as a medical, I think, transcriptionist. She was studying to be a paralegal and had taken a course in contracts. And the cases that we cited in our brief, including Kinney and Rinaldi, suggest that even a high school education is enough to weigh that factor in favor of the person seeking to enforce the release. With respect to the time for consideration, plaintiff testified that she knew about these buyout packages as early as the end of August of 2006, and that she knew as soon as she heard about it that she wanted to participate in the program. Plaintiff has suggested, or at least plaintiff's counsel has suggested, that plaintiff was not allowed to take a copy of this waiver agreement off the premises at Ford, and that is directly contrary to her admissions in the record and her admission on summary judgment. Plaintiff testified that she received information regarding the buyout package before she even was laid off, which was on August 22nd, and that included a four-page explanation of the STEP program, the fourth page of which is a blank copy of the application and waiver agreement. And on summary judgment, we put in a fact, and we said she received this information, including a copy of the application, and she admitted that fact. So there was no, you come in and you can't take this off the premises. She had a copy. She produced it to us in discovering this litigation. So I don't think that that's a question which she can develop by then giving later inconsistent testimony. With respect to the time frame, she had 4 or 5 weeks to even sign up for this program once the enrollment period started. So even if you think you couldn't take it off the premises, she could have looked at it and come back any time 4 weeks later to go ahead and execute it. And she admitted that she had that time period. Even after she signed it, she had any time up until her retirement date or termination date, which here was January 1, 2007, in which to withdraw that application. She never attempted to withdraw that application. Plaintiff's counsel says he heard about this agreement from his client sometime in January. I think he said he got a copy of it sometime in January. Plaintiff testified in her deposition that around the time she was considering this, she attempted to call her lawyer and that there was some sort of miscommunication, and apparently she did not reach him. But again, she was represented by counsel for almost a year before she signed this waiver agreement. Nothing prevented her from contacting her counsel. She was not discouraged from contacting her counsel. And I don't believe that the fact that Ford knew she had a lawyer means that Ford suddenly takes on responsibility to make sure that she is communicating with her counsel. As far as anyone from Ford knew, her counsel had looked at it and said, go ahead, this is a great deal. And I think plaintiff counsel may have said that here this morning, that if you talked to her, he probably would have said this was a good deal and go ahead and take the agreement. So that kind of begs the question as to why we are here. But she had, you know, we cited cases in our brief, including the Mullinson versus BFI case and the Kinney case, where they say it's the access to counsel, it's the ability to take it to counsel, not actually the counsel's participation, which is the important factor here. She had a lawyer, and again, nothing prevented her from discussing this with her lawyer, and she had almost 4 months from the time she first heard about this until the withdrawal period to talk to her lawyer and to get his advice and decide whether or not this was or was not a good deal. Again, we talked about the consideration here. She got $100,000 for this minus withholdings. She has never offered to tender this back, and we submit that she does need to under the Fleming case and also the NutraSweet case to tender this back to Ford if she wishes to proceed with this. The record evidence is that she did not actually cash this check until the end of January. So based on the timeline, I think the plaintiff's counsel's put forward, he was aware of the agreement even before she cashed the check, and again, did not attempt to decline to cash that check or to accept the consideration. Plaintiff had cited really three cases in their brief, Light, Milam, and Smith v. Orrington. We've distinguished all of those in our briefing, and I believe that I'll just touch upon those briefly. But in the Light case, which was a Sixth Circuit case, I think from 1981, there was no agreement in that case at all. The state agency, which was investigating the plaintiff's administrative claims, administratively closed that when the plaintiff got a promotion that he said had been denied from him on an impermissible basis. So that case even distinguished itself from cases where there was actually an agreement entered into. The Milam case is very similar in that that was resolved through the grievance process, and there was no agreement signed in the Milam case. It was just the union and the company negotiated an agreement, and in fact, in that case, the union sent a letter to the plaintiff saying that they were not waiving their Title VII claims, and the court found that very significant. In Smith v. Orrington, again, the union rep said, you need to go ahead and resolve this here because there's nothing else you can do about it. There's no suggestion that any representations were made to plaintiff in this case, that she had to sign this, that she was not giving up her claims. And again, we submit that the language is clear. Plaintiff has noted that his client is bipolar. Again, there was no evidence anywhere in the record that she couldn't understand this release, that she was incapable of voluntarily entering into this agreement. And again, that was not raised at the court below at all, and so I don't think that can be a basis here. And I would encourage the court to look at the NutraSuite case, which we cited, in which the release there was really just a letter to a group of employees who were part of a reduction in force. It didn't say waiver at the top. It was just in there, and it said sign here if you want your benefits. And the court found and enforced and affirmed the dismissal of the claims of those employees who had just signed that letter. I think my time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Well, not once did I hear from counsel why they did not contact the plaintiff's attorney when they knew that she had a pending charge of discrimination on file with them. The personnel department knew about it. My office had been in contact with them.
What rule of law requires that?
Well, the Illinois Rules of Professional Conduct require that it is improper to have direct communication with a person known to be represented by counsel. And probably the same rule here in this circuit and the same rule in the district court. So that would be the rule. I think this case just slipped through the cracks at Ford. Had they gone through her attorney's office, we probably could have had an agreement, but it did not. And let's look at the ambiguity in this contract. It says here, I waive and release any and all rights or claims I may have against Ford, its agents, and agree not to institute any proceedings of any kind against Ford. Well, she had already had a proceeding on file with the EEOC and the Illinois Department of Human Rights. So this says nothing about any claim that's already pending. Then the next paragraph down says that this waiver does not waive any rights or claims that may arise after this waiver is signed or if it is not permitted by law. After she signed the waiver on October 16, 2006, she got a right to sue letter on, November 17th, 2006, about a month later. Then she filed her Title VII charge, I think, December 6, 2006. Doesn't say anything about, I mean, she's already got a case pending. There's nothing, this is a contract of adhesion, which is fine, but, wait, is my time over?
Time's
over. Oh, I'm sorry, it goes fast. All right. Okay, thank you. All right. It would be very unfair to enforce this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. We'll move to the last.